We begin in a high-ceilinged room with towering chandeliers, seven-foot windows, a fireplace, and some very old portraits of famous Supreme Court justices. In that room last week, I found myself face-to-face with an intellectual giant who came in a very small package. Supreme Court Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, all 80 years of her and not much more than 80 pounds of her, sat down at the Supreme Court and gave us 30 minutes in the famous Lawyer's Lounge, the room where lawyers giving oral arguments get to spend a little time either cooling or cooking their nerves, thinking about what they're going to say before the nine justices when they present their case. Ginsburg spoke about many things to us, and we will hear the full interview in two parts today and tomorrow, but we especially wanted her thoughts on the role of Congress when the president acts as commander-in-chief and orders the U.S. military into action. Ginsburg says under Article 1 and Article 2 of the Constitution, Congress is all-powerful, even if it sometimes doesn't seem that way, when the president is threatening or even ordering a military strike.
I think almost always with Congress's approval, if not a formal vote, tacit approval, Congress could always stop the president if Congress thinks that what the president has done exceeds the president's authority or is just wrong for the United States. You can go back further in time to what I consider to have been a very wrong judgment. It was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's executive order that people of Japanese ancestry were to be removed from their homes on the West Coast and placed in detention centers. There was no law that authorized that. And Congress certainly knew what had happened and did nothing to stop it, let it go on. So I think there's a shared responsibility, whether Congress takes formal action or not, for when the United States is acting in the interest of national security.
Justice Ginsburg reminded us that it's what Congress doesn't do that is often more important than what it does in cases of national security, and particularly as the debate over what to do about Syria shifts from one end of Pennsylvania Avenue to the other. At a moment when political institutions in Washington are lacking credibility, Justice Ginsburg actually spoke with reverence about the court. Being a Supreme Court justice, she told us, is a remarkable place from which to view the operations of the U.S. government. She was very candid in her interview with us, her answers as sharp as when she was a legendary litigator in the 70s and 80s, just as she is not shy today on the bench, with a reputation as being one of the more vocal justices during oral arguments.
I do ask questions. I think we have an obligation to put to the lawyers the points on which we think the case may turn, so they have their best shot at answering. It's great to be in the position of asking questions and not having to answer questions. I know many a lawyer would like to respond to our question with another question, but that's not cricket.
So many people in America today think of the American government, the legislature, the executive, the presidency on some level, our political system, to be broken or frustratingly divided and incapable of moving forward on issues of our day. Lots of people describe that as the government being broken. People did not describe the judiciary as being broken. What's it like to work in an institution in a frustrating moment in the history of Washington that does work, an institution that absolutely carries out its mission and does what it's supposed to do?
One aspect of appellate judging is we have to give reasons for all of our decisions. And when you sit down and try to write it out, sometimes you find that your first judgment wasn't the right one. And to make the institution work, people have to put aside their own egos and work for the good of the court. We all revere this institution, and we all want to leave it in as good shape as we found it. The current court is unusually collegial. You might not get that impression from some of the 5-4 decisions, but they surely are. That has not always been so. When Justice Brandeis was appointed by President Wilson. His immediate predecessor, McReynolds, also a Wilson appointee, would leave the room when Brandeis spoke because he was an out-and-out anti-Semite. The year Brandeis joined the court, there was no group photograph. McReynolds refused to stand next to Brandeis. So there have been times, there have been justices who just didn't get along with each other, but there's none of that on this court. We all respect and even like each other.
Thinking about your career, and it's, of course, wrong to try to link specific personal histories with legal decisions, but in general, the way in which you were treated in academia and in the law firms that didn't give you an offer, for instance, after you graduated from law school, was a change in the way that women were treated in the legal profession and in the judiciary. Did that change in your life ultimately reflect a change in the law, and you were responsible for so many decisions that changed discrimination law for women? I'm wondering, for a woman or a lawyer starting out today, how one should look at changes they see around them, unfairness they see around them, and how that can translate into actually changing the Constitution in the way that you did in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
I didn't change the Constitution. The equality principle was there from the start. I just was an advocate for seeing its full realization. The Declaration of Independence starts out, all men are created equal. So I see my advocacy as part of an effort to make the equality principle everything the founders would have wanted it to be if they weren't held back by the society in which they lived, and particularly the shame of slavery. So I don't think my efforts would have succeeded had it not been for the women's movement that was reviving in the United States and more or less all over the world at the time. And the court was certainly aware of that sea change in what the public thought women ought to be doing. A great constitutional law scholar, Paul Freund, once said, "The court should never be influenced by the weather of the day, but inevitably they will be influenced by the climate of the era." And that's what happened in the 1970s. Judges had daughters and granddaughters, and they began to recognize that some of the so-called favors for women were not favors at all, but they were locking women into a small piece of man's wide world. So it was the change in society that opened the court's eyes and made my arguments palatable when they would not have been a generation before.
Would you say today that climate is technology and privacy law and the changes that are taking place in the way people communicate and how that affects the First Amendment and law enforcement and the Fourth Amendment, for instance?
Yes, there are just a host of problems spawned by the electronic age, things we couldn't even conceive of. I was amused by the analogy that Justice Scalia made in a case about a GPS tracker. So you don't know that's being done to your car. Is that a violation of your right to protection against unreasonable searches and seizures? So Justice Scalia imagined a constable clinging to the bottom of a carriage as it went on its way. So there was some notion that there is an official eye that's on you, but you don't know about it. Yes, there are all kinds of challenges. And as de Tocqueville said, sooner or later, in the United States, every controversy ends up in court. I think that says great things about our judicial system. or even the cases that I brought. Take the very first one, Sally Reed, who attacked an Idaho statute that said, as between persons equally entitled to administer a decedent's estate, males must be preferred to females. Well, Sally wanted to administer the estate of her 17-year-old son, who was a suicide. When he was staying with his father, he took one of his father's many rifles and killed himself. Then the father put in an application, and the probate judge said, Sally, the law tells me what I must do. Even though you filed first, males must be preferred to females. That woman, who made her living by caring for elderly and infirm people in her own home, she thought that a wrong had been done to her and that the legal system would make it right. So she brought that case with a lawyer from Boise, Idaho, through three levels of the Idaho courts. Every one of the plaintiffs in the cases that I litigated in the 70s was just like that, an everyday person who thought that they had experienced a wrong and that the courts would make it right. It says a lot about the federal judiciary.
On a completely different subject, you've cited Justice Scalia, who we understand is your friend and shares your love of opera. It's often said that at a certain point in a justice's career, there's a kind of question always hanging in the room of when do you hang it up, that sort of thing. Who do you think, in your view, are better at deciding when it's time to quit, opera singers or justices?
I don't like to pigeonhole people or give categorical answers. There are some singers that know exactly when to go, and others hang on much too long. And that is the same with judges. My own view, and I've said this many times, is as long as I can do the work full steam, I will stay on the court. But when I feel myself slipping, when I forget the names of cases that I once could recite at the drop of a hat, I will know.
Tomorrow, more of my interview with Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on her celebrated cases and opinions and why she believes the Second Amendment is virtually obsolete. This is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.